Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.illinois.edu. I'm Kimberly Cronick, guest hosting this hour for Celeste Quinn. Addiction touches the lives of one of every 10 Americans. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with William Cope Moyers, Vice President of External Affairs at Hazelton, a Minnesota-based organization that helps people reclaim their lives from the disease of addiction. Mr. Moyers himself is in long-term recovery from alcohol and crack cocaine addiction. He is a married father of three children and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. Mr. Moyers will be the keynote speaker tomorrow night at the Prairie Center Health Center's Health System's 40th anniversary celebration and fundraising dinner. The Prairie Center is a not-for-profit organization that provides comprehensive substance abuse education and treatment for youth, adults, and families in East Central Illinois. Today, we will talk with Mr. Moyers about his personal journey of recovery as well as the stigma and discrimination that still surround people with chemical addictions. We'll also talk about effective treatment and continuing care, public policy, and where to go for help. As always, you're invited to join the conversation. The number locally is 217-333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. Joining me now by phone is William Cope Moyers. Welcome, Mr. Moyers.
Well, thank you for having me on, Kimberly. I'm glad to join your program this afternoon.
Very glad to have you with us. First of all, thank you for your survival and for your willingness to tell the very difficult story of your addiction and the very inspiring story of your recovery.
Well, you're welcome. You know, I'm really just one of the very fortunate ones who was given one more chance to take personal responsibility for learning how to live with my chronic disease, the disease of addiction, and I made it, sometimes despite myself, sometimes despite an illness that would rather me be dead than to be coming to your community tomorrow night. I'm in Washington, D.C. today to speak at the National Cathedral, and then I'll be coming on to Illinois tomorrow. And I really do carry a message of hope and help so that other people can perhaps be inspired to hold on to the opportunity to get well. And I'm really glad to have the chance to come and help the Prairie Center celebrate 40 years of helping the communities there deal with addiction to alcohol and other drugs.
Well, great. We're very, very pleased to have you with us. And, you know, your journey of awareness and acceptance of your disease, and as you mentioned, you're taking personal responsibility for managing this chronic illness, is really strong evidence that recovery from drug and alcohol dependency is possible with the proper treatment and lifelong support after treatment. You make it clear in your book that drug and alcohol addiction not only affect the person with the illness, but also the person's loved ones. And you talk about the help you received and receive from your parents, Judith and Bill Moyers, your wife, Allison, and all of those still in recovery who came before you and whose survival is an inspiration to you. Tell us a little bit about the support that you received and how important that is to staying sober.
Well, you know, addiction is a disease of isolation. It's a disease of private shame. It's a disease of hopelessness, a feeling of helplessness. And the antidote to it is community. It's group. It's not. I don't recover by myself. That's impossible. I recover through the we of the program that is so important to my recovery, the 12-step program. And I'm very fortunate that even when I'd given up on myself, even when I really wanted to die back in the early 1990s. My wife, Allison, did not give up on me. My employer, CNN, did not give up on me. My parents, Bill and Judith Moyers, did not give up on me. And I think it was that safety net that really helped me to come back from the abyss of death. And I think it's so important for anybody who might be listening to the program today and might be struggling with alcoholism or drug dependence to realize that you're not alone, that what is going on with you out there, the listener, is not unique to you, that there are many, many people in Illinois who struggle with addiction, but there are many, many people who find recovery, and it's okay to ask for help. I was always sort of reticent to ask for help, in part because I was raised to be a resilient person and raised to believe that I could do anything I wanted to do as long as I put my mind to it and had a little bit of luck and a good break or two. But when it came to my addiction in the 80s and early 90s, I was too ashamed to ask for help. I was too ashamed to accept help. I was too ashamed to even admit it that I admitted needed to admit that I needed help. And I think it's so important, and part of the message that I bring tomorrow is that there is a chance, there is a way out of this seemingly hopeless condition. It's through the good work of places like Prairie Center. It's through the good work of other programs across Illinois. And in reality, addiction is a disease that doesn't discriminate, and neither should recovery. There's a lot of recovery happening in Champaign and Urbana and other places, and I'm coming to tap into that celebration of recovery that is so important to so many people like me.
Your book is very well written, very difficult to read, very inspiring to read. It's called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. And I noticed that you wrote it, you co-authored it with Catherine Ketchum. Now, in your first career, you worked as a journalist at prestigious big city newspapers, later on TV at CNN, in your mother and father's production company making films for PBS. You could have written the book probably on your own. Why did you choose to work with her? Was that part of your recovery, part of asking for help?
You know, it's a great question. A lot of people have asked me that in different ways. I am a good writer. I was raised, I graduated in 1981 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in journalism from Washington Lee University in Southern Virginia. So, I have a good background as a journalist. I know how to write. I know how to report. But what I thought was important in connecting with Catherine Ketchum, who is an accomplished author in her own right, was to connect with somebody who could help me get out of my head and get down into what I call the hole in my soul. I can very easily stay up in my head. I can very easily write analytically. I can even write from the perspective of being in recovery all these years. But Kathy's brilliance and her key role in this was not just in helping to organize some of my thoughts, but to sort of get me to open up a vein, as she called it, and to bleed onto the paper. Not just bleeding all the negative consequences of my use, but to bleed the emotion of the spiritual journey that is the essence of my story and so many stories like mine. So, yeah, I could have written a book on my own. I don't think it would have been the same book. I think it would have been more perhaps a manual or a how-to book and not so much a book that recounts my spiral downward and my slow climb back, and that spiritual element that, as I said earlier, is so critical to the journey.
I remember reading, I think it was before your fourth time in treatment, you went back to the crack house, I guess it was in Harlem. You had two children at the time, were married to your second wife, Allison, whom you're still married to, who is also a long-term recovering, I believe is an alcohol, recovering from alcohol addiction, is that right?
Yes.
And you wrote that you didn't go there to get high one more time. You actually went there to die.
That's right.
That was your, yes.
My disease, you know, addiction is a chronic illness, and it's also a progressive illness. And if it's not treated and if recovery is not part of the process, then it only gets worse. And in the early 90s, actually it wasn't in Harlem, it was in Atlanta where I went back to the crack house in 1994. I had relapsed after 3 years of continuous abstinence. I had relapsed because I did not continue to work the program of recovery that's so important. And when I relapsed in 1994, it was devastating. And I didn't pick up where I'd left off in 1991 when I had first gotten sober. I picked up somewhere much further down the road, and I went right down. I mean, I slid into the dark abyss of despair and near death almost immediately within a couple of days. And I did go to the crack house in utter agony of being unable to live in my own skin, being unable to live with or without using. I went there to die, and on the morning of October the 12th of 1994, almost 14 years ago, I was delivered, as I said. I mean, I don't get a whole lot of credit for that. I guess I had something to do with it, but not really. My wife and my family and my employer were there for me when I wasn't there for myself. And I got back into treatment, and I've been in continuous long-term recovery since the morning of October the 12th of 1994.
And you talk about how your it was your father, your mother, they came in there and they grabbed you. And was that the time when he said, I mean, and your father and mother are so loving, and they've just, and you dedicate the book to them, how you say they were with you every step of the way.
Yes.
And that was before you met Allison. And, you know, I think your father said that he hates you, and your response was,
I hate me too. And I think that's the power of addiction. You know, my father is the journalist Bill Moyers, and he's well known probably to a lot of your listeners. You know, public radio is part of the good ideas empire of journalism. There's not much of it left, but public radio is one place that it is. PBS is another, and my father's been a mainstay at PBS for a long time. But I think the power of the story and my parents' willingness to be part of it and to share some of their own experiences really underscores that addiction doesn't discriminate, that it doesn't really matter who you are or what you aren't. It doesn't matter if you're the son of two loving, accomplished parents like my parents, Bill and Judith. It doesn't matter if you're a farmer from, Springfield. It doesn't matter if you have if you're black or white or any other color. It doesn't discriminate, and it devastated the Moyers family, just like it devastates lots of families across the country. And my parents were blindsided by my spiral downward, at least initially, and in the end, they had some of the same emotions that I'm sure a lot of parents have. They were just furious with me, although as they were later to learn that it's okay to hate the disease as long as you continue to love the person who has it. And I think that's one of the most powerful themes of the book, is that even though I came from the background that I came from, even though I was raised with everything, I lacked for nothing emotionally, morally, financially, spiritually. My father's an ordained Southern Baptist minister. Even though I had all of that stuff growing up, I still had a brain that processes alcohol and other drugs differently. And when I began to casually experiment when I was a teenager on Long Island growing up in the 60s and 70s, my brain was hijacked and drugs stole my soul to the point that I ended up in a crack house and almost died.
We're talking with William Cope Moyers, author of the New York Times bestseller Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. Mr. Moyers himself is in long-term recovery from alcohol and crack cocaine addiction. He is a married father of three children. You are invited to join the conversation. The number here is 217-333-9455, 217-333-9455, or toll-free anywhere you can hear me, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Mr. Moyers, you talk about how drugs hijacked your brain. I think many people, and there's a stigma around people who are addicted to drugs and alcohol, is that there's some kind of moral weakness or laziness, or there's an I don't care attitude. I mean, it's, some people would say, how could you leave your two children and your, or how could you smoke crack while you were watching your son and your wife was away? Or how could, you know, it's obvious you love them, but then how did you make this choice? People say, well, that's not love, because love doesn't make that choice. Tell me about the brain. We're learning more about how the brain has these stop-and-go centers, and that addiction actually is a disease of the brain, and some people have it and some don't, and you have it. And in your book, you talk about the first time, I think it was, you smoked marijuana, and your description is so different from the experience of the casual user. Could you recall that for us?
Sure. I mean, the point of it is look, addiction's not an excuse, but it is an explanation as to why rational people do irrational things, why good people do bad things, why moral people do immoral things. I mean, my story is powerful because it really does underscore that it doesn't matter. It often doesn't matter what your upbringing is. I mean, I was never abused. I lacked for nothing, as I said. I had it all. But I also had this other thing going on, which I wasn't aware of at the time. Again, it's not an excuse, but it explains why these things happen to 1 in 10 of us, as you noted. My brain, for reasons I can't, quite explain, but science is certainly helping us understand, my brain was set up was wired differently to process mood and mind-altering substances. And when I voluntarily ingested marijuana into my body at the age of 16 or so, it turned on a light switch in my brain which I could not turn off on my own. I developed what I call that baffling inability to just say no. Again, I voluntarily ingested that substance. Nobody made me do it, in the same way that nobody made me legally drink alcohol at age 18 when the drinking age was 18 in 1977. I experimented. I mean, a lot of teenagers do, a lot of adults do. But what it did to me is different than what it does to most people. And part of that is due to the fact that I do have a brain that processes it differently. Most people who will listen to your program today can maybe go home tonight and have one, maybe two glasses of wine, one, maybe two beers. That'll help take the edge off of a good or a bad day. It'll help them relax. It'll be a reason perhaps to celebrate a birthday or an anniversary. There's nothing wrong with that. But for some of us, addicts and alcoholics, one is too many and a thousand are too few. And we cannot on our own turn off that ability to stop. That doesn't mean we don't take responsibility for our recoveries. Nobody can make me recover, and I've been continuously abstinent since 1994, in part because I am enrolled in the process of recovery. And for me, that's a lot of things. I have to take responsibility for managing my illness, but I can't take any responsibility for what happened to me because I didn't certainly aspire to grow up to be an addict and alcoholic. It's not what I wanted to be when I got older, and that's what happened to me because, as science is telling us, addiction is fundamentally a disease with origins in the brain.
We have a caller on line four from Chicago. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I have a question for you. You mentioned your first marriage and how you're now married to your second wife.
Yes.
I was just curious, was your first marriage, was it affected by your addiction? Is that what ended it, or... you know, what was it that made you realize your addiction and made you change?
That's a great question, and it's a fair question. And I write quite in detail about what happened. I was married in 1981 to a woman that was essentially my childhood sweetheart. We got married in 81, 82 with great promise and no idea of what was happening. And we were married from 1982 until I hit bottom the first time in a crack house in Harlem in 1989. And in August of 1989, when my then-wife, Mary, took me to the psych ward of a hospital in New York City, they checked me in there, and they asked her at the time, what is your husband here for? And she said, I think he has a short-term alcohol problem. So they wrote that down on the intake sheet, and then they asked me to come into the assessment room, and they said, what are you here for, Mr. Moyers? And I said, I'm here because I have a long-term drug problem. Well, addiction is a disease of denial, not just for the person who has it, but for those around that person, especially family members. And addiction is a disease which impacts much more than just a person who has it. It really takes a toll on the family. And, of course, when my wife, Mary, at the time, found out that she'd essentially been married to a person who was secretly using alcohol and other drugs for the entire marriage, it wiped out that marriage. Why? Because drug use fundamentally involves dishonest behavior. It involves secrets, and no marriage can be expected to survive without a great casualty can survive dishonesty. And I was a dishonest person in the 1980s. I take full responsibility for it. Mostly dishonest around the fact that I was secretly or behind the scenes using those substances, and of course, It wiped out that level of trust that is the essence of any relationship, and the marriage didn't make it. The woman that I subsequently met through early recovery, who like me is in recovery, Allison, we've been together now for almost 18 years, it's worked out okay. But absolutely, my first marriage was a casualty of my drug use.
Okay, could I ask one more thing?
Sure.
Okay. You also mentioned that your job at CNN.
Yes.
You obviously have worked there for a long time, so you were kind of able to function still
yes.
in your work environment, although this was affecting every other part of your life.
Well, I didn't really function. When I was hired at CNN back in 92, I was sober. I was recovering at the time. I'd gotten sober again in 91 for the second time, and I was clean and sober for the 3 years I worked there until I relapsed in the summer of 1994. I was a very high-functioning person when I was sober, and I did very well at CNN. And the irony of it was that when I relapsed in the summer of 94, I almost immediately became dysfunctional, if you will. I started not showing up for work. My work was unpredictable. Sometimes it was very good, and sometimes it was very bad. But, and I think this is a key point, when I was hired at CNN in 1992, I had told them that I was in recovery. I told them I had been through treatment. I was honest with them about that. So that when I did relapse, while it certainly was not a pleasant experience for anybody, it did not completely catch them unawares. And they were very, I don't want to say sympathetic, but they were very understanding or flexible in terms of allowing me the time that I needed to finally get recovery. And when I was done with my treatment in 1994, they let me come back to my job, and I continued to work there for a short time until I decided to move back to Minnesota to pursue what ultimately would become my vocation, which is my work at Hazelden.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And was there anything anyone could tell you, or was there anything anybody could do prior to you feeling that you hit bottom that would have helped you realize, you know, what was going on sooner? Or
maybe you mean when I relapsed?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question.
Initially.
Well, back up in the 80s when I became when my addiction became very active and sort of subsumed my whole life, mm-hmm. I didn't know I was an accident alcoholic. In fact, I remember waking up about a year before I hit bottom the first time in 89. I remember waking up one day after a terrible night and thinking, you know what, if I have a problem, I might need to get help. I wasn't ready to admit that I had a problem. I wasn't quite certain what getting help meant. But there was nothing that anybody could tell me because I wasn't in the right frame of mind to understand it. However, during the course of the next 5 years, between 89 and 94, I knew what I needed to do to get sober, and I knew what I needed to do to stay sober. I needed to work my program of recovery, and I did that for a long time, except that in the mid-90s or in the early 90s, I became distracted by my work, by the fact I was raising two children, and all of those things that sort of are called life. And I got distracted from paying attention to what really mattered, which was continuing to maintain my sobriety. And, of course, as any addict and alcoholic knows, nothing is more important than our recovery, for without it, we have nothing. And if we don't continue to go to meetings and connect with our higher power and stick with other people who are like us, we typically begin to run into trouble, and that's what happened to me.
And just also, for the people who love someone with the drinking or alcohol drug problem, there are programs for those folks who love people who are addicted. Programs like Al-Anon help those. And by helping yourself, it often can help the person who's addicted get into recovery, although that's not the goal. But there are programs for loved ones as well. And I believe your mother, Judith Moyers, is in Al-Anon. Is that right?
Well, she'd have to tell you that. But the fact of the matter is that that's right. I mean, this is a disease, as I said, that affects much more than just the person who has it. It affects everybody around that person, particularly families. And, for example, at Hazelden, we have a family program. And the family program is not for the addict and the alcoholic. The family program is for the loved one, be it a spouse or a child or a parent who've been adversely impacted by that person's addiction. And oftentimes I get phone calls and emails from people saying, you know, my son is in a crack house in Indianapolis and he won't come out. What do I do? And I say, go to the family program at Hazelden for your sake, not for his. Somebody will say to me, my wife is still actively using prescription medication, and I can't get her to stop. What should I do? I say, go to Al-Anon. I mean, whether or not the addict and the alcoholic recovers, the family member has an obligation and a right to recover, and that's why the family program is so important to the family members.
Thank you, and we're going to move on now to another caller on line one from Urbana. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Mr. Moyers.
Hi.
My name is Bruce Wardini. I'm the CEO here at Prairie Center.
Hello, Bruce. I'll see you tomorrow. Yes.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm hearing the program. Great message. And I guess my question for you is we have approximately 300 people coming to your event. And my question is, how can you deliver the message to the whole community to basically re-energize themselves, because I think 40 years of trying to get the word out about addictions is a long time. And how do we keep those active voices going?
Well, Bruce, I think you're doing it in some ways. I think you got to give yourself a little bit more credit. First, here we are. We're on the program today.
Right.
I think you helped to make that possible for me to be on public radio. You've invited me to come to your community. I'm going to do that. Now, the reality is I'm going to leave Friday and go back to Minnesota where I live, and you all will still be down there in the trenches doing that good work. I think the best thing we can do is what we're doing, which is to be public about addiction treatment and recovery, to be on the radio, to go to the legislature in Springfield, to contact the media in Chicago or Urbana or wherever, to get our alums at Prairie Center and at Hazel Inn and other facilities to be willing to carry the message back into their communities, into their churches, their Rotary clubs, in letters to the editor of the local newspaper or in call-ins like this one. I think what we have to do is continue to do what we're doing. We just have to do it with better organization. And to that end, Bruce, one of the things that you and I can talk about tomorrow, but I think is apropos for now, is we need to get treatment programs like Prairie Center to really tout your success. I mean, you treat a chronic disease. You don't cure a chronic disease. You treat a chronic disease, and you do a really good job. Not everybody who comes to Prairie Center finds recovery. Of course not. Just like diabetes or breast cancer or hypertension, not everybody can recover, unfortunately, at least not yet. But what we need Prairie Center to do is to say, look, we've been in this community for 40 years, and we're making a difference in the lives of literally thousands of people who come to us and get well. And when they go back into their communities, they become taxpayers, they become engaged citizens, involved parents. They're employees, they own homes. I mean, the fact of the matter is that recovery is possible, and Prairie Center is at the forefront of making that happen.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. We had a young man tell us the other night this is the first time he's ever paid into taxes because he's been in prison, and when he got out after his addiction for meth, that he's finally become a responsible citizen again. My other question to you is this. We all know that 22 million people actively have some sort of an addiction problem out there. And on a national scene, and I think that's where you're going, is trying to advocate and be a voice for the policy change that needs to take place. But and coupled with that, what we're seeing is the numbers of people who don't have health insurance, do not have any form of a rider on it that would deal with their addiction to alcoholism. How can we change policy in order to get people into treatment?
It's a good question, Bruce, and I think we have to do it one step at a time, no pun intended. You know, the sad reality is that addiction is a disease in which discrimination is rife. Insurance companies, public policy leaders, most people who can affect change discriminate or see addiction differently than they see other chronic illnesses. I understand some of that discrimination because, unlike other chronic illnesses, addiction is an illness that oftentimes has a behavioral component that causes people to break the law or do bad things while under the influence, be it drive drunk or rob a liquor store or domestic abuse. I understand all that. But what we've got to do is to stand up and speak out collectively across Illinois and put an accurate face, not just on the problems of addiction in Illinois, but an accurate face on the realities of recovery. We've got to organize to do that. And one of the ways to do that is through a group called FacesAndVoicesOfRecovery.org, which is a 501c3 based here in Washington, where I am today, that I helped to set up in the late 90s. I have no financial interest in it. I just did it because it's all about advocacy and getting people to put a face on the not just the problem, but the solution. But beyond that, we have to get our state legislature in Illinois, just like we have to get our Congress here in Washington, to accept the reality that the most effective way to fight this so-called war on drugs is not by raiding crack houses in Chicago, not by raiding methamphetamine labs in Urbana, but is the most effective way to get on top of this problem in Illinois and across this country is by promoting prevention, research, and treatment. It is a crime that people who want to go to the Prairie Center to get help oftentimes cannot use their insurance to access treatment. It is a crime that people who need to go to the Prairie Center can't find the public funding that is so necessary. I mean, I work for the Hazelden Foundation. We're a not-for-profit that's been in business a little longer than Prairie Center. We've been in business since 1949. We give $5 million a year in patient aid, and most of that patient aid or financial assistance goes to employed middle-class people with private health care insurance whose insurance will not treat addiction like it'll treat any other illness. That's discrimination. It's wrong, and it's got to change. And there is legislation currently pending in the House of Representatives that I believe is scheduled for a vote sometime in the middle of March that would expand access to addictions treatment through private health care insurance. It's called PARITY, P-A-R-I-T-Y, PARITY legislation. And I would hope that Prairie Center will lead that fight in letting your members of Congress know that it is imperative that they support that legislation when it comes to the floor for a vote sometime in the middle of March.
And is that the bill that was named after the late Senator Paul Wellstone?
Yes, I don't have it down exactly, but it is the Paul Wellstone Mental Health and Addictions Treatment Equity Act.
Yes.
And I don't remember the number off the top of my head right now. I should know that because I've been lobbying this legislation for 12 years.
Mm.
And the United States Senate finally at the end of 2007 approved a version of this bill. It's not the best version, but it's still a step in the right direction. And as I said, I received an email today from a lobbyist here in Washington saying that Nancy Pelosi has scheduled a vote for sometime around the 12th, 13th, 14th of March. And I would hope, Bruce, that everybody associated with the Prairie Center will rise up and write a letter to whomever your congressman is, I can't think of him off the top of my head, and let that member of Congress know how important it is for his or her constituents to vote affirmatively when it comes to this parity bill. It's not the end-all. It's not the cure-all. But if we can get parity passed the House and the Senate, President Bush has vowed to sign that legislation, and then it would allow employed people who have insurance to use their insurance to seek treatment at good places like Prairie Center.
Well, thanks for the challenge, and we'll definitely do our part in that. And I'll let you go, but I'm really looking forward to seeing you and have a good flight into Champaign-Urbana tomorrow.
Well, thanks, Bruce. I hope I can get out of here. You know, I'm looking out the window of my hotel here, and if you can believe it, it's snowing in Washington, D.C. And the mere suggestion of a snowflake in the air is enough to send this city scurrying. So let's just pray that I can get through my speech tonight at the National Cathedral and can get on that airplane tomorrow and get to see you tomorrow night.
All right.
We'll be doing that. You're listening to William Cope Moyers, author of the New York Times bestseller, Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. Mr. Moyers himself is in long-term recovery from alcohol and crack cocaine addiction. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Kimberly Cronick. People who live with someone or know someone or love someone who is addicted and is trying to get help to recover may be frustrated that relapse is a common part of the disease of addiction. In fact, some people lose everything before they get sober, their children, their spouse, their job. They end up in jail. They prostitute themselves for money for drugs. And some people die before they can get and stay sober. You were in treatment, Mr. Moyers, four times before you were able to have your over 14 years now of sobriety. What does good treatment involve? And there was a key point I remember in your book, Mary. You I think it was your third time. You were in for the standard amount at Hazelden, and then they recommended you stay longer. But you had a choice to stay or to go. And I remember you wrote all the responsibility on your shoulders and how much you wanted to prove that you would be the good recovered person. You could do this. You could lick this disease. And you didn't stay for the longer treatment, and you did eventually relapse. But when you went back into treatment and you had that chance to stay, I think it was longer, months, I think it was Mary's permission that really helped you out, that you knew that she was going to be there, the family was going to be there when you stayed even longer in treatment.
Well, that's right. It wasn't Mary. It was my wife, Allison.
Excuse me.
And that's right, and that was in 1994. You know, what is an interesting and perhaps unique dynamic with the disease of addiction is that it is an illness that convinces the person that he or she doesn't have it. It is a disease that convinces the person who needs help that they can do it on their own or do it differently than what the experts say. I mean, I talk to patients in treatment programs all the time, and I say to them, you know, if you had a brain tumor and you sought treatment at the Mayo Clinic or some other top-notch, you know, treatment program in the country for treating cancer, and the oncologist told you to stand on your head in the corner every day and sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, and that might improve your chances for recovery, would you do it? And everybody says, well, of course I'd do it, because I want to beat brain cancer, and that's understandable. So then I ask, why is it that when we are in treatment for addiction to alcohol and other drugs, that we don't do what we're told, that we don't go to any length, that we'll do 80% of what we're told, but we won't do the 20% we need, you know, really to do? That's what happened to me. I mean, I was in treatment three times between 1989 and 1994 before my fourth treatment, and each of those times I would do some of what I was told, but I would never do absolutely what was necessary to recover. And as we in recovery know, we have to go to any length. That's literally a quote from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are willing to go to any length, quote unquote, to find recovery. Finally, when I got my last chance after my horrific relapse in the fall of 1994, I knew I was broken. I knew I was beaten. I knew that if I did not do what I was told, if I didn't go to any length, I wasn't going to make it. And so I went to treatment. I told Allison at the time, look, Allison, I cannot be your husband and I cannot be the father to these two small boys if I don't stay in treatment and do as I'm told. And she gave me, quote, permission, if you will, she released me from the obligations that we all have in the rest of our lives, and she allowed me to focus on what was the most important thing. And that was my treatment. And it worked. I mean, treatment is only as good as the patient's willingness to do what they're told. As I said earlier, in the same, you know, you can go and get treatment for diabetes, but if after you get your initial treatment, you're not willing to take your insulin and regulate your diet and exercise, then you're not going to recover. The same is true with people who have heart disease. If they are told to reduce stress, stop smoking, don't eat red meat and exercise, and you don't do those things, then you begin to mess with the formula for success. The same is true for addicts and alcoholics. If we don't do what we're told, the chronic disease tends to come back and we relapse.
We have, I think, time for one more caller. We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Regarding the sick fellow that killed several people at Northern Illinois, a couple of stories from the news press I got inferred that, well, he came off his medicine, therefore he was more likely to do something erratic. But then on WGN, when they had his girlfriend on, someone said, might have been her, someone else said, he stopped taking his medicine because it made him feel like a zombie. And that could have been the tipping point. The medicine actually could have, in fact, already tipped him over the edge of where he was. Now, if I were a doctor in California and, say, Kamirzak had come to me, I would have written him a prescription for marijuana, and maybe he would have kicked back then and mellowed out instead of gone on a killing rampage. Do you have any feelings on this matter?
No, I mean, it was a tragedy for the community. I think mental illness probably had some role in it. That's not an excuse for what happened, but it helps to perhaps explain it. I'm not an expert onto the particulars of that case, number one, and secondly, I think it was a tragedy for all involved. I don't think prescribing marijuana was going to be the answer any more than telling the person to go off of his meds. There's just a lot about that case I don't know. But I do know this, that mental illness does cause rational people to do irrational things. And if you read the particulars of that story, it seems like the gunman was a pretty fine fellow for much of his life. And it also seemed like perhaps, you know, he was doing okay until he wasn't. Why he snapped and could have anything been done differently, I just don't know.
And I just got a note from our producer that on Monday on Afternoon Magazine, we'll have a guest who can answer the caller's question about medicine and mental illness and some of the circumstances that surrounded that shooting.
Good.
So stay tuned for that. We have just a few more minutes. I want to talk a little bit about what you talk about your children, how you talk to your children about addiction, Mr. Moore. As we know that It seems like many medical experts believe that most drug and alcohol addiction develops between the ages of about 18 and 25. And you and Allison have three children and are both recovering from addiction. How do you talk to your kids about addiction and the risks? And how does any parent talk to their child? What should we be doing as parents to sort of prepare and support our children and protect them from addiction, if at all possible?
Well, it's a good question, and I think, you know, each parent has to formulate their own tools, their own response plan for talking to their children about drug and alcohol use. But it's pretty easy in my family for two reasons. One, because I wrote a book, and it's a memoir, and so my children have all read it. Henry is almost 16, Thomas is 14, and Nancy is 11, going on 18, and they've read the book, and they know what their mother and father have been through and what they're all about. So my life is an open book, no pun intended, for not just the general public, but for my children specifically. But there's another reason why my wife and I are so open about our addiction, our recovery, and that's because there's a genetic predisposition with this disease. And do you realize that my three children are 5 to 10 to perhaps 15 times more likely to become addicted than their classmates at school? And that's only because they're the product of two alcoholics. Now, my wife and I are in long-term recovery, but nevertheless, there's probably a pretty good likelihood that at least one of our three children has the gene or the susceptibility in the brain that means that if they experiment with illegal drugs or even casually use legal drugs, alcohol being the legal drug in this case, there's a likelihood they're going to develop the same problem. So we are very open about explaining that to our children and telling them what they need to do to be on guard. But there's one other really important point to this. We tell our children that if you choose to use mood and mind-altering substances, you may not be able to choose the outcome. And if the outcome is consequences that lead you down the road of addiction, it is okay to ask for help. I mean, there's such a shame and a stigma around this illness that people oftentimes don't ask for help. And so what we tell our children is, Henry, Thomas, Nancy, it is okay to ask for help. Come to your parents and let us know that you've developed a problem, and we'll try to get you the help that you need and deserve to get well.
That's beautiful. Wonderful. Thank you for that. I want to make a quick correction. The caller about the shooter at Northern University, that'll be on Focus on Monday, this Monday on Focus. Mr. Morris, you talked about your children have all read your book. I want to just go quickly back to Mary, your first wife. Has she read the book? Are you in touch with her at all? Is there any reconciliation on her part towards you or anything?
I don't know. She was aware that the book was coming out. I gave her a heads up. I think she was a little bit apprehensive about how she'd be portrayed in it. She's a hero in the book, and she's a shining example of how this illness can devastate not just the person who has it, but the people who love that person. Whether she read the book, I'm not sure, and what her reaction to it is, I don't know.
Okay. One final question. We have about 2 minutes here. You give a great deal of credit in your book to your family, to Allison, to many, many people, and you talk a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous and the recovery community in St. Paul and other places where you've been able to keep your sobriety for going on 14 years now. Now, anonymity is an important principle in AA and other 12-step programs, and people need to know that whom they see in these meetings and what's said stays in the meetings. That anonymity creates a safe space. Now, individually, members may tell whomever they want that they're recovering addicts. But why do you think 12-step programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous hold to the principle that members should also remain anonymous at the level of press, radio, films, and TV? Wouldn't stories like yours do a great deal to move people forward to a greater understanding of this as a disease?
Well, yes. And in fact, during this interview for the last hour, I have not disclosed to you what program it is that I recover in. I've talked about the 12 steps, but I don't speak for any 12-step movement, and I don't represent any 12-step movement. That said, I did break my anonymity in the book simply because I felt like I owed it to the reader. If I was going to explain how the disease of addiction took me down, I owed it to the reader to explain how it is that I recover, because there is no cure, and treatment isn't the end. It's the beginning of the journey. I've been abstinent for 14 years because I am in a 12-step program that works for me on a day-to-day basis, one day at a time. And And yet I really value the anonymity principle of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and other programs, because it allows people to feel comfortable in those rooms or in those meetings. And it also keeps Alcoholics Anonymous out of public debate. And that's so important. I mean, AA's been around since 1935, and thank goodness, because it works for a lot of people. But at the same time, people like me can write books, or we can stand up and speak out. We can go to the legislature in Springfield. We can come to the Prairie Center dinner tomorrow night. We don't have to do it as members of a 12-step movement. We can do it as people who have been down that road of addiction and are on the road of recovery.
Mr. Morris, I've really enjoyed talking with you this afternoon. I appreciate all the time you've spent with us. I appreciate all the callers who called in. I hope you have a great speech and a safe flight to Champaign-Urbana tomorrow for the keynote speech you hope to give at the Prairie Center Health System's 40th anniversary celebration and fundraiser dinner. Thank you, Mr. Morris, for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on and allowing me to carry the message of hope and help to others.
You're very welcome. I'll see you tomorrow night at the dinner. You've been listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.illinois.edu. I'm Kimberly Cronick, guest hosting for Celeste Quinn. I want to remind our listeners that you can go to our website, and many of the resources we talked about today are linked on our webpage. If you want others to hear this interview, it will be archived, and you can listen on demand anytime online. The time is 1:52. The settlement should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. With those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Kimberly. Taking a look at the numbers as they finished up in Chicago on a Wednesday afternoon. Futures in the wheat pit down 16 cents today in the nearby March contract for the soft red, a high of $10.42, a low at $10.08 1/4. Settlement price once again 16 cents lower at $10.20 for the March soft red winter wheat in Chicago. May futures at $10.53, top bottom at $10.21 1/4. Settlement price at 10.33 1/2, down 14, and July futures down 5 1/4. The high at 9.62 3/4, the low at 44 3/4. Settlement price at 9.54 1/2, down 5 1/4. September futures 9.64, the high, the low at 52 1/4. Settlement price down 1.5 cents at $9.59. And December wheat at 9.76 1/4, top bottom at 57 1/4. Settlement price 4.5 lower at 9.66 1/2. Next year's July for 2009 up 9 cents. At $8.80. Spring wheat nearby contract down 45 cents at the end of this trading day at 8.15. The May at 17.5 lower at 15.30. And December, which is just after the harvest month there, down 4 3/4 at the spring wheat at $10.57. March corn futures now 5.24 the high. The low at 5.13 1/4, settlement price at 5.23 1/2, up 3.5 cents. May futures 5.36 1/2, the high, the low at 26, settled at 5.36, up 3.5. And July 5.48, the high, the low at 37.5, settlement price at 5.47 1/2, up 3 1/4. September futures 5.47 3/4, the top, the bottom at 37, and settlement price at 5.47 3/4, up 2 3/4. In December futures, 5.48 1/2, the high, the low at 39.5, a settlement price at 5.48, up 3. March contract from the corn pit, 5.56 3/4, the high, the low at 47, settlement price at 5.56 1/2, up 4 1/4. And the May, a finished price, 5.56 1/2, up 4.5 cents, rather 4 1/4 cents there. May futures had a high of 5.56 3/4, a low at 5.47. July futures, a 5.60 settlement price, they finished 5.5 cents higher. March soybean futures, $14.03, the high, the low at 13.85. A settlement price at 13.97 3/4, down 3/4. In the May, 0.75 cents lower, 14.19 3/4. The top, the bottom at 14.04. Settlement price at 14.17, down 3/4 for the May soybeans. July futures 14.32, the high, the low at $14.16. Settlement price at 14.30 3/4 cents, up 0.75 cents. In the August, gained a nickel today, 14.21. The high, the low at $14.10. Settlement price at 14.19, up 5 cents. November beans gained 5.5 cents. The high at 13.68. The low at 13.46. Settled at 13.66, up 5.5. And your January contract at 13.73. Top, bottom at 59. Settlement price at 13.73. 8 cents higher for the afternoon. March oats for the day up 7 cents at 3.75. Bean meal futures for the products, March contract 3.63.10. The high price for the day, the low at 3.58.70. A settlement price at 3.60.40, down $1.30. May futures were at 366.60 at the end of the day, down $2.30 for the afternoon. March bean oil futures 60.78, the high, the low at 59.59, settled at 60.68, 47 higher for the day. And the May futures finished at 61.47. They were up 50 cents on the afternoon. At just about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today, that's about 10 minutes away, we'll join the closing market report this afternoon, talking with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. We'll take a look at the ag futures market with him. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City will join us just after the bottom of the at that hour to take a look at the ag weather segment. And Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain in Terre Haute, Indiana will join us too. That all happens during the closing market report for Wednesday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now let's turn our attention to livestock contracts. March feeder cattle, 105.75, the high today, the low 105 even. The settlement, 105.65, that up 75. April, 108.90, the high, 107.92 and a half, the low. The settlement, 108.75, up 87 and a half. May, 111.80, the high, 111 even, the low, 111.75, the settlement, that up 77 and a half. August, 112.95, the high, 112.45, the low. The settlement, 112.87 and a half, that up 32 and a half. February live cattle, 92.10, the high, 91.45, the low, 92.07 and a half, the settlement, that up 70. April, 95.20, the high, 94.10, the low, 94.95, the settlement, that up 102 and a half. June live cattle, 95.05, the high, 94.25, the low, 94.97 and a half, the settlement, that up 82 and a half. And August live cattle, 97.47 and a half, the high, 97 even, the low, the settlement, 97.45, that up 55. April lean hogs, 65.45, the high, 64 even, the low, 65.07 and a half, the settlement, that up 55. May, 73.80, the high, 72.15, the low, the final, 73.77 and a half, that up 70. June, 79.50, the high, 78.37 and a half, the low, 79.45, the settlement, that finishing up 60 cents. July lean hogs, this contract's high today, 79.55, the low, 78.90, the settlement, 79.52 and a half, that up 25. And February bellies, 95.50, the high, 93 even, the low, 93 even, the settlement, that up 50. The Dow is up 124 points at 12,461. The NASDAQ is up 25 at 23.31. The S&P 500 up 14 at 13.63. And oil is up 59, and it stands at $100.60 a barrel. You're tuned to AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock, 17 degrees in Urbana. A lake effect snow and blowing snow advisory is in effect for a portion of northwestern Indiana through this evening. A winter storm watch is in effect for portions of southwestern Illinois from Thursday morning, tomorrow morning through Friday afternoon. And for the rest of southern Illinois and extreme southwestern Indiana from Thursday morning through late Thursday night. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in northern Indiana, mostly cloudy with bands of lake effect snow. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny. Highs ranging from around zero in far northwestern Illinois to 33 in southeastern Indiana. Tonight in northern Indiana, mostly cloudy with lake effect snow showers. In southern Illinois, becoming mostly cloudy with sleet, freezing rain, and snow arriving after midnight. Elsewhere, clear to partly cloudy. Lows ranging from 15 below zero in northwestern Illinois to 20 in southern Indiana. Tomorrow, in extreme southern Illinois, cloudy with freezing rain and sleet. For the remainder of the south, cloudy with snow early, then sleet, freezing rain, and snow. In central sections, becoming mostly cloudy with light snow and flurries arriving. And in the north, partly sunny. Highs ranging from 10 in northwestern Illinois to near 30 in far southern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly sunny and cold. The high near 20. Tonight, clear this evening, then increasing cloudiness and very cold, the low 4. Tomorrow, becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of light snow during the afternoon, the high 26. Coming up next, news from NPR in Washington and the Closing Market Report with Todd Gleason. Stay tuned.